This episode of the History of Religions and Their Gods is dedicated sincerely to my friend, Michael John Mamone. Definitely gonna need some lube and probably some chapstick for this one, guys. Hey everybody, welcome back to the show, and thanks again for listening. Just a couple things that I want to talk about before we start getting into the episode is I think the last episode we left off were about a couple weeks maybe before my birthday. I turned 56 on January 30th. And what a calamity of errors that was. So my actual birthday, just having some dinner, having some friends over, having some drinks, having some cocktails. I have an upstairs pool room, you know, a nice big billiard room, and upstairs shooting some pool. And for whatever reason, I decided I need to run downstairs and get some more wine. The key word here is run downstairs. Well, about four steps into the stairs of this entire flight of stairs, I slipped, fell smack on my side on my rib cage, like right where the floating ribs are, and then I slid all the way down to the ground. Like, yeah, like a xylophone, you can imagine, on my ribs. Ding, 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 ding. I was immediately out of breath. I made myself, you know, go to bed, what have you. Next day, I woke up. and I was in excruciating pain. I have a very good friend, Dr. Joe, that lives down the street a little bit. Came over, did an assessment, listened to my lungs, and basically wrapped me up, put me on Norco and all that, these anti-inflammatories and all these different high prescription drugs just to try to deal with the pain. So that's 3 weeks ago now. I'm still in crazy pain. Now I feel like the ribs slipping up and down, and they're obviously broken. But anyway, I'm managing the pain. I'm wrapped up, and so that's how my birthday went. Then a week after my birthday, which was the Pro Bowl. Okay, so think about it. My ribs are just like, they're wrapped up. I'm sleeping out in the living room so dogs don't jump on me, and just so I can sit up on the sofa. And when we were at the Pro Bowl, somebody brought this coleslaw from Knollwood's. You guys know that restaurant here in LA. It's off the 5. It's got like the white snowy roof. Not bashing them. Typically, it's really good. But for whatever reason, come about 2 a.m. Monday night, 1 week after I broke my ribs, I wake up in a sweat, just a hot sweat, and I could feel the vomit working its way from my stomach all the way up into my mouth. And this whole time I wake up immediately and I'm like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, this can't happen. I'm going to break a rib throwing up after not broken already. I roll out of bed onto the floor, the tile floor of the living room, and crawl to the kitchen where I not only vomit into the sink, sorry for listening to this right after breakfast, but I am shitting myself. Nothing that I can do about it. I go into this back spasm. It was the craziest thing. Full on back spasm. I drop down to the floor. My head hits the refrigerator. Now I'm laying on my back and I'm butt naked, mind you, because as I was shitting myself, I peeled off my underwear. It's a beautiful sight. My wife hears me. I'm laying on my back on the tile floor, gurgling on my vomit. She comes running over, and because she had just been sick 2 hours prior and basically already went through this thing. And so she came out to check on me, saw me on the floor, grabbed me by my arm, rolled me over on my side so I can actually continue being sick. That went on for about an hour. Got back into bed. And it turns out that everybody that was at that Pro Bowl party got sick from off the coleslaw from Knollwood's. And then last but not least, so here, now we're 3 weeks out. 3 weeks back on my birthday. And I'm not going to get choked up, but this episode is dedicated to my friend, Mike Mamone. For those of you who are living in the Los Angeles area, or in the Orange County area of California. You saw on the news the gentleman in Dana Point that was hit by a car, by a guy on his, hit by a car. He was on his bike, and the guy got out of the car and proceeded to stab him to death. So tomorrow, Thursday, I will be going to his memorial, and it's gonna be tough, guys. It's gonna be tough. But so this episode is dedicated to him. So as you listen to it, just give a little, mic my money. Rest in peace, brother. Rest in peace. The author for Mark provided several key pointers to the epics in order to inform the reader of his teasing play between revelation and then concealment. Revelation being, of course, what he wanted to give away for free, and the concealment, what he wanted to make the reader work hard to find. Unfortunately, these flags seem to have been invisible to some readers, even to a sophisticated Greek like the author for the Gospel of Luke. Because Luke missed all of Mark's clever hypotexts. Hypotext, of course, being the illuminating statement, place, name that would lead the reader somewhere else and start making comparisons. And instead, this author for Luke just elaborated on the stories, making them his own, and completely missed the point. Mark must have been long on the concealing and short on the revealing. But no matter how you dice it up, the reader from Mark in the late first century, serving as a historical extension to the Paul's original seven letters, were more than likely understood as allegorical to some, which was the Norman mystery cults at the time, and understood as true stories to others. That's why by the time Matthew arrives, sometime in the in the late 80s, we start seeing so many unique branches of the religion, and each one going a different direction, such as the Gnostics, or Marcion, or the Ebionites, right? Or the Nazarenes, or the Essenes, as an example. Christianity was widely diverse in all of its principles. Our earliest evangelist, the author who wrote the book of Mark, he was not writing a historical biography, as many Christians all around the world want to believe today, but instead a beautifully handcrafted novel, a prose anti-epic of sorts. Now, more striking than the similarities between these epics and the Gospel of Mark are found in their differences, such as poetry versus prose, mythical heroes versus historical heroes, or many gods versus one god, and so on, and so on, and so on. But these differences are significant, but they're also precisely what the reader would expect and was looking for, quite frankly. Homer and Mark wrote in vastly different literary and cultural, religious, and even political environments, as they both had these widely divergent literary objectives. The unique differences require no special explanation of any kind, but the frequent parallels between the epics and the Gospel of Mark cry out for explanations to the reader, or the hearer for that matter. Now, I've been talking about this for a while, and some people just view the similarities as coincidental, or even accidental, or just literary commonplaces. But the poet's unparalleled domination in Greek education ensures his influences on a wide range of texts, especially on Mediterranean cultures in general. Therefore, some parallels found between Mark and Homer just might be due to Mark's Greek cultural identity and nothing else. But as we shall see, we can safely argue for a lot more. Because several parallel passages reveal deliberate, transvaluative interplay with the epics, whether Mark worked from manuscript or from memory alone. Now, scholars who study intertextual referencing, such as allusions, parodies, and imitations, well, they've long recognized the subjectivity of the enterprise, and they've addressed the problem in several different ways. Now, on one hand, we have the philosophical fundamentalists who require unmistakable markers of dependence. When I say dependence, I mean such as Mark being dependent on Homer to write his gospel. And they search for things such as shared vocabulary, similar genres, and distinctive grammatical or poetic constructions. And any similarities that do not meet these criteria are simply considered as accidental confluences. So where some scholars encounter textual similarities, they might just dismiss them as coincidental or accidental. Now there's another group, another extreme group, and they're referred to as literary universalists. And they're basically interpreters who argue that the meaning actually occurs during the reading of the book itself, where the reader is equipped with like a treasury of information from many texts and on their own make intertextual associations, even though the author may not have intended them to be. Now, indeed, the author is a hermeneutical irrelevance, because those using this approach need no more be interested in comparing Mark with ancient literature than with Finnegan's Wake. Then we have other theories, other scholars, that attempt to test the similarities between the texts with criteria that's more flexible than those required by the fundamentalists, of course. They're more harmonized with rhetorical education and more attentive to the remarkable variety of ancient intertextuality and more sensitive to the delicate interplay between occulting and emulative disclosing. But unfortunately, no list of criteria, however sophisticated, can altogether help clarify the fuzzy logic of intertextual referencing. Because the criteria are tests. They're not laws. Now, scholars like Dennis MacDonald, they had to develop a set criteria, usually deriving from the works such as the Acts of Andrew that blatantly and outwardly revealed its literary borrowing and its imitation to serve a specific purpose, and typically to criticize something or someone in a semi-veiled manner, you know, basically talking shit about someone behind their back while standing right in front of their face at the same time. Now, some authors were way more outward with their criticisms, while others made you dig a little bit deeper for whatever reason, probably in fear of backlash because it was usually political in nature. But either way, everyone did it. Scholars had to learn from each other, working on similar problems, including those who specialized in allusions to Jewish scripture found in the New Testament, as well as the allusions in classical text and Latin poetry. The criteria are accessibility, analogy, density, order, distinctiveness, and interpretability. Now, in terms of the criterion accessibility or availability, basically accesses the likeliness that the author actually had access to the hypotext in the first place. The hypotext being the original literature, whether it be Homer or Virgil, so on and so forth. Because the more widespread the proposed target of imitation is, the stronger the case is for imitation. And the parallels here identified so far do satisfy this criterion. So quoted here, if a Greek had owned any book, that is, papyrus rolls, he was almost as likely to have owned both the Iliad and the Odyssey. And we will discover that many of the stories found in Mark's gospel actually share parallels in the Homeric epics because Homer and his myths were in the air that Mark's readers were breathing. And then the second criterion is analogy, which seeks out the place the proposed Homeric parallels that fit within a tradition of imitation inside of the same model, The more often ancient authors imitate a particular story or characterizations or even plot elements, the more likely it is that Mark did too. And on the other hand, the case for rewriting is weaker if no one else imitated this aspect of the epic. And then we have density. Criterion number 3. Now this element, it pertains to the volume of context between the two texts, that of the Odyssey and that of Mark's Gospel. Because density is determined by bulk, not by count. Such as parallels between two texts may be numerous, but they may also be trivial. Such as, well, he said, or they went, or she replied. Not even a legion of this kind of parallels could demonstrate imitation. However, as few as 2 or even 3 real beefy or weighty similarities would and could demonstrate imitation. And then in the 4th criterion, it's order. Order. It's related to density to that degree as it accesses the sequences of the parallels. The more often two texts share content in the same order, well, the stronger the case for literary borrowing or dependence exists. Now, in the 5th criterion, we have what is called distinctiveness. Now, this is where, on the occasion, that two texts contain some distinguishing characteristics, such as some peculiar characterizations, or a sudden and unexpected change of venue, or perhaps an unusable word or phrase that just doesn't seem to fit. Now, in fact, some interpreters consider this to be the best test of borrowing or dependence on another piece of literature, where a rare word or expression in one passage picks up a corresponding rarity found in the preceding passage, serving as an unequivocal marker for allusion that should call to the reader's eye. Unfrequently, however, these rarities are flags for the readers to compare the imitation text to their models. Then last but not least is the criterion for interpretability, or intelligibility, which is the capacity of the proposed hypotext to make sense of the hypertext, right? Now, this may also include the solution to a peculiar problem that has managed to elude of explanations. It also may include emulation, like, you know, comparing itself equal to, or even perhaps transvaluation, which is where it basically criticizes the hypotext. Now, for instance, can one understand why an author targeted a particular antecedent and how they transformed it to serve their own ends? Well, Mark and imitations frequently and always satisfy this criterion by exalting Jesus at the expense of the vices or the weaknesses of the heroes and their models, right? Comparing Jesus to Moses or to Odysseus or to Hector, so on and so forth. Now, criteria 1 and 2, well, they're environmental, having to do with literary activity in the author's particular atmosphere, what was happening in his particular day. And then criteria 3, 4, and 5, well, they all test for similarities between the two texts, including potential flags of literary dependence. But the 6th criterion here, however, looks for the differences between the texts as evidence of emulation. Now, one could illustrate these 6 criterion on a host of ancient imitations, but in this case, we're going to use Mark as the tale that also appears in Acts 20, verse 7 through 12, written by the same author for Luke sometime around probably the mid to late 90s. On the first day of the week, when we covened to break bread, Paul spoke to them, and because he wanted to leave the very next day, he prolonged his speech until midnight. There were plenty of lamps in the upper room where we were gathered. A certain young man named Eutychus was seated at the window and was carried off by a deep sleep, because of Paul's having spoken for so long. Carried off by this deep sleep, he fell from the 3rd-story window and was lifted up dead. Paul went down and laid upon him and embraced him and said, "Don't raise a ruckus, for his soul is in him." Paul then went back upstairs, continued to break bread, and once he had eaten and had spoken for a very long time, all the way until dawn, he then left. Then he took the lad alive, and were not little relieved. Now that's what Paul's voice sounds like inside of my head anyway. I don't know about you guys. But now back to the story. Because this story most certainly appears to share so many uncanny similarities to Homer's characterization of Elpenor. Because after having spent a year with the goddess Circe on her island home of Aia, Odysseus insisted on continuing his journey back to Ithaca. And Circe provided a lavish dinner prior to the embarkment. And Odysseus spent the night with her, learning the magic that he would need in order to summon from the dead the blind seer Tiresias, who could tell him how to ultimately find his way home. And at the break of the day, Odysseus woke his crew from their deep, dinner-induced sleep to sail at once for their rendezvous with the dead. All sailed off, but Elpenor. And then Odysseus speaks here. Now with my best Odysseus voice. There was a man, Elpenor, the youngest in our ranks. None too brave in battle, none too sound in mind. He strayed from his mates in Circe's magic halls, and keen for the cool night air, sodden with wine, he bedded down on her roof. But aroused by the shouts and tread of marching men, he leapt up with a start at dawn, but still 2 days, for he forgot to climb back down again by the long ladder. Head first from the roof he plunged, and his neck snapped from the backbone. His soul flew down to the house of Hades. Oblivious to Elpenor's death, Odysseus sailed to the edge of the world, where he performed the necromantic magic in order to call forth the soul of Tiresias. To Odysseus's horror, the first soul to meet him was that of Elpenor, who told the hero how he had died and begged him to burn his corpse in full armor and to bury his ashes along with due rites. Don't sail off and desert me, left behind and unwept, unburied. Don't, or my curse may draw God's fury on your head. No! Burn me in full armor, all my harness, heap my mounds by churning graff serf, a man whose luck has run out. So even men to come will learn my story, prefer my rites, and plant my tomb, that oar I swung with my mates when I rode among the living. I know, that was really sad, right? But Odysseus did keep his promise to his friend, and indeed, after he had won his traveling instructions from Tiresias and saw a host of the dead, even witnessed punishments of the wicked, Odysseus returns his ship to Aia, where he beached his ship at night. And Odysseus told the king Alcinous of the Phaeacians what had happened next. Now let's see if I can remember Odysseus' voice. As soon as dawn, with rosy fingers, shone again, I dispatched some men to Circe's hall to bring the dead Elpenor's body. We cut logs in haste, and out of the island's sharpest jutting headland, held his funeral rites in sorrow, with streaming tears. Once we'd burned the dead man and the dead man's armor, heaping his grave mound, hauling a stone that coped it well, we planted his balanced oar aloft to crown his tomb. Now, a comparison of this mythical tale to Luke's Eutychus reveals several similarities, because the introduction of the two youths are actually the same. For example, there was a man, Elpenor, the youngest, to a certain young man named Eutychus was seated at the window. And then both narrators shipped the vice from the first person speaking, I, we, to the third person, and then both call the victims of the fall a youth, using the same Greek word. Both named him, and both contains the words identical in Greek, and a certain in the second and third positions. Now Homer states that Odysseus's crew gave away to sweet sleep, while the author for Luke's Eutychus was overcome by deep sleep. And Elpidor died when he woke up, where Eutychus, when he dozed off. And both fell down to their deaths. Now, for example, he fell from the roof, or he fell down from the third story. And both of these sentences contain that same word in Greek for the third person singular of fall, down, and roof. Now, twice Homer says that the soul of Elpenor rushed off to Hades. And on seeing him there, Odysseus sobbed and said, "I wept, and my heart had compassion on him." And then the Christians in the city of Troas from Luke's story, on the other hand, did not need to lament, because unlike Elpenor's soul, which was immediately and forever banished to hell, well, Eutychus' soul instead stayed with him. Now, in the netherworld, Elpenor's soul asked Odysseus to return to Circe's island to mourn and to bury his dead body. And the king of Ithaca did so the very next day at dawn. So both here in Acts 20, the resolution of the victim's predicament did not occur until dawn. And Odysseus could only mourn and bury his dead friend, whereas Paul's God brought the fallen youth back to life. Odysseus himself didn't fetch Elpenor's body. His comrades did. In sorrow with streaming tears. And similarly, Paul did not receive Eutychus' corpse, brought the lad living, and were not little relieved. Now, there can be very little doubt that an educated Greek author, like the guy that wrote the book of Luke and the book of Acts, had access, fulfilling criterion one, to the story of Elpenor. Because of his strategic location immediately prior to, at the beginning of, and immediately following one of Homer's most memorable and controversial episodes. Elpenor became one of the most ancient household names, even in Christian households. Even Clement of Alexandria cited this example of Elpenor's fall in order to discourage Christians from drunkenness, and absolutely must have assumed that his Christian readers would recognize the allusion of broke his neck when he fell down because he was drunk. Additionally, in Luke's little tale here, well, guess what? It also satisfies the second criterion as well. Do you guys all remember what it is? It's analogy. Because so far, many ancient authors, including all of Luke's contemporaries, they all modeled their characters and their stories after Elpenor. Even Virgil was particularly fond of him as well, many years before, that created two characters after him in his Aeneid, Palinurus as well as Misenus. In fact, Elpenor's literary legacy underwent its most important transformation in the hands of Plato, who in turn was to have imitators of his own. And we can see that at the end of the Republic by Plato, Socrates even provided his own interpretation of the netherworld, just to replace Homer's version of life after death, with one that not only punished the wicked, but also rewarded the righteous. In the Odyssey, he once upon a time was slain in battle. And when the corpse were taken up, on the 10th day already decayed, was found intact. And having been brought home at the moment of his funeral, on the 12th day, as he lay upon the pyre, received, after coming to life, related what, he said, he had seen in the world beyond. He said that when his soul went forth from his body, he journeyed with great company, and that they came to a mysterious region. Now, Air in the story, who is the son of Arminius, then goes on to articulate a mythical account of reincarnation that would be suitable to Plato's Socrates. How and in what way he returned to the body, he said that he did not know. But suddenly recovering his sight, he saw himself at dawn, lying on the funeral pyre. Now Plato's Socrates then goes on to recast the tragedy of Elpenor into the revival of Air, who gave a most satisfactory account of the afterlife than in Homer's version. Error himself is a metaphor for Platonic reincarnation. We also need to consider Plutarch, because he was a contemporary with the author who wrote the Gospel of Luke, as well as the Acts of the Apostles, sometime around the mid-90s. Well, he writes about a man named Thespesius, who had squandered away his youth, until he saw the punishments of the wicked in Hades for himself. He had fallen from a height, struck his neck, and died. And then he revived on the day of his scheduled burial and told everyone what he had seen in the netherworld, while borrowing motifs from both Homer's Nekia, which is basically rites by which ghosts were called up and questioned about the future, and also Plato's myth of Ur. Now, writing sometime around 170 to 180 of the Common Era, Apuleius. Well, this guy tells us a story about a young thief named Alcinous, which literally in Greek means valiant. The very quality, the very word that Homer denied his Elpenor. Because like Elpenor, Alcinous was also foolish and died from a fall at night and did not receive a proper burial. He therefore was unlucky, just like the unlucky Elpenor. Apuleius almost certainly expected the smartest and the cleverest of his readers to see here the twist on the story of not-so-Alcimus Elpenor, not such a lucky Elpenor. So the claim that the author for Luke imitated Homer's story of Elpenor places him within a thriving literary tradition of ancient mimesis, imitation, and borrowing. Just like Luke's Eutychus had literary siblings. This is not writing history from a perspective of someone who traveled with or knew Jesus or heard stories about him. This is literary borrowing to express a personal opinion or a point about something or someone else. Okay, so now at this point of the episode, I want to reel this in a little bit and kind of do a nice little closing for the episode. So I'm going to do a side-by-side between the Odyssey and Acts 20, verse 7 through 12 to shed any doubt that the parallels are enough to satisfy the criteria of both density and now, as you will see, order. Because they're more lexical, they're more detailed, and even way more sequential than the rewritings of Elpenor's story by Plato, Plutarch, Virgil, and Apuleius. Now, I will do a side-by-side. The first one will be the Odyssey, and then I will do Acts. Now, the first one. Odysseus and crew left for Troy and sailed back to Achaia. Paul and the crew stopped at Troas, having left Achaia to sail back to Jerusalem. And then, narration in the first person plural. After a sojourn, the crew and Odysseus ate a meal. Just same thing in Acts, narration transitions to the first person plural. After a sojourn, the believers and Paul ate a meal. In the Odyssey, disaster came at night. In Acts, disaster came at night. In the Odyssey, the crew slept in Circe's darkened halls. Where in Acts, there were plenty of lamps in the upper room. Elpenor fell into a sweet sleep. Eutychus fell into a deep sleep. Then the narration again switches to the third person. There was one Elpenor, the youngest. Well, Luke does the same thing. The narration now switches to the third person. A young man named Eutychus. Elpenor fell from the roof. Eutychus fell from the third story. Elpenor's soul went to Hades, where Eutychus' soul remained with him. Associates fetched the body dead. Associates took up the body alive. Elpenor not buried at dawn. Eutychus was not raised alive until dawn. Now those are pretty good, right? Well, these parallels also satisfy criterion number 5 as well, because this author for Luke retains distinctive features from Homer's story. For example, Homer and Luke both shift from first-person plural narration to the third-person at precisely the same point in the story, right when the authors introduced the young men. Both stories concern the status of the boy's soul after death, and both mention the fetching of their corpse at dawn. The very mention of youth falling from the height to his death might be sufficient enough reason to relate the two stories, but Luke provided two more even clearer markers of myth by his hypertextuality. Now, I found it really interesting that the author for Luke placed the story in Troas, which is situated in the Troad, which is a mere 10 miles south of the ancient city, the famous city of Troy, right? Lots of folklore come out of there. Like many other ancient cities, Sigeum was renamed Alexandria in honor of Alexander the Great, and to distinguish it from its namesakes was known as Alexandria in the Troad. But long before Luke's time, it had become simply known as Troas and continued to enjoy its Trojan fame. Now, according to Suetonius, rumor had it that because of Rome's mythological affinity with Troy, via Aeneas, Julius Caesar considered moving the capital from Rome all the way to Alexandria, also known as Troas. In fact, Suetonius explicitly identified Troas along with the legacies of Troy. And by placing the story of Eutychus in Troy, Luke seems to be hinting that one should read it in light of Troy's mythological traditions. Now, one of the most important hypertextual clues is found in the name Eutychus itself, the name that the author for Luke invents. He doesn't actually invent it, but you'll see what I mean here. Because Homer repeatedly emphasized that Elpenor had bad fortune. Elpenor had bad luck. He was just an unlucky dude. The young soldier survives the Trojan War, Laestrygonian cannibals, and Polyphemus, the monster in the cave, the Cyclops, if you would, and then only to step off Circe's roof to his doom after he survived all that stuff. Elpenor himself stated that he was the victim of an evil fate and called himself an unlucky man. His buddy Odysseus as well addressed him as unlucky. Now, our Christian buddy Eutychus, on the other hand, simply means, and say it with me, everybody, while you're in your car, lucky. That's right. The Greek word literally means lucky. And we know that significant names were common in Greek literature and as early as Homer himself. Now, when Apuleius wanted to call attention to his rewriting of the Elpenor story, well, he did so by naming his main character Alcimus, which means valiant, and from declaring from the beginning of his bad luck that he could not attract the approving nod of fortune. And considering the other similarities between the two stories, the selection of the name Eutychus hardly seems accidental at all, or even coincidental, because it is so damn distinctive. Despite Luke's hypertextual flags, no reader for 2,000 years seems to have ever noticed them, even though this was common practice among ancient people, which just goes to show that the gospel stories were more than likely only presented and taught and read to ignorant and or illiterate. And then the sixth and the final criterion is interpretability. That is the presence of transvaluation or emulation. Because not only are the two stories identical, at the same time, they're strategically dissimilar to serve a specific purpose. For example, at dawn, at Circe's island, Odysseus was unable to raise back to life his unlucky friend Elpenor. However, Paul, on the other hand, through the power of Jesus, was able to raise Lucky on the Troad. Plato had emulated Elpenor and Er. A warrior who returned from the dead to narrate a tour of the netherworld, unlike Odysseus. The reviving of Er symbolized reincarnation. And likewise, transvalued Elpenor in Eutychus, whose reviving symbolized the resurrection. Now, this little digression from Mark all the way to Acts accomplishes two related objectives here in this particular series. First, it demonstrates the method that I will be using throughout this mini-series, including the six criteria for mimesis. Then second, it sets the stage for the identification of who the two young men are that appear at the end of Mark. The youth who fled naked from Jesus' arrest, and then the youth in Jesus' tomb Easter morning. As I will demonstrate, they are a singular character who emulates Homer's Elpenor.
This has been a Skeptical Ghost Heathen production.